According to lifelong gardener Barbara Damrosch, growing food is an undeniably radical act. In her latest book, A Life in the Garden, Tales and Tips for Growing Food in Every Season, Barbara, now in her 80s, invites others to join her in tending the earth and celebrating the harvest. And she shares practical and personal advice for novice and experienced gardeners alike. I'm Holly Cederholm, your host for a conversation about local food and organic agriculture brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Today's episode of Common Ground Radio is a special conversation with Barbara Damrosch about her new book and her life in the garden. We talked in her Brooksville, Maine home, which she shares with Elliot Coleman. After they married in 1991, the two began collaborating in the field as four-season farm, as well as on the page, similar to another iconic gardener-author duo, Helen and Scott Nearing, who are well-known for their book, Living the Good Life. Barbara counts the Nearings as a major influence on her relationship to the land, and Four Season Farm is actually sited on acreage previously owned by the Nearings and purchased by Elliot in 1968.
Your new book begins by sharing your own journey as a gardener, and I'm curious, why do you grow food, and are the reasons you started growing food the same today as when you first started out?
Well, I first started out when I was a tiny little girl. The book begins with my being exposed to my grandparents' garden in Louisiana. I was a city girl. I lived in New York. I loved it out there. I just loved roaming the place. And it was somewhat farm-like. And then later on, my parents left New York, sort of retired to Connecticut before they re-retired to Maine. And they took up gardening seriously, and it was partly my mother's upbringing, and she was a wonderful cook, and so she wanted to have good ingredients. My father was a pediatrician, so I think almost anybody, even back in the dark 60s, 50s, I should say, would know that growing your own food was something healthy to do. And so, and we all got kids got involved. You know, I had two sisters, and we all totally enjoyed gardening. It was the pastime.
You enjoyed gardening when you were young because it already sounded like you had a connection to food because your mom was a good cook. It brought you closer to being outdoors. What are some of the reasons you garden today?
I mean, so many. You could start with the political side of how I think that it's a way of controlling your life. There's a lot of ways we can't control the world around us. And one thing we can control, if we want to embark on it, is getting our own food supply. I think for a lot of people, it could be a economic necessity or improvement. In my case, it's much more the satisfaction of knowing how fresh it is, what's gone into growing it, how it tastes, the fact that it's right out there, I can go grab it, you know, that kind of thing. There just seem to be so many good reasons to do it. And a lot of people think they can't, so I have to try to explain to people that you can do it in a very small space. Your backyard has no sunshine, let's say, but your front does. Well, grow it in front. It can be just as beautiful if you keep it well. Rows of these different colored plants, I think that's beautiful. And it's hard for some people to find time, but you don't need a lot of time. Just grow some of your favorite crops, some of the ones that are so dramatically better when homegrown, like tomatoes or freshly harvested salads and things like that. You don't have to have a 2-acre orchard. It's nice, but
yeah.
One tree might be it.
Yeah. So in that list of reasons for gardening, you named the political first. And I pulled out a quote that you wrote, and I want to ask you about this quote, so I'm going to read it back to you first.
Yeah.
So, you write, "I have sometimes read about creatures that are inherently savvy about imminent danger, like the wild animals that race inland and upland when they sense from far away that a tsunami is coming, or dogs that can tell if you're about to have an epileptic fit. I like to think that we too have an innate scrap of good sense that tells us when the outlook is dark to head for the nearest piece of earth and make it bountiful." So this is in the context of you citing like World War II, the Great Recession, COVID-19 as these times when people
World War I too.
Yeah, where people take to the gardening en masse.
Yeah.
But then you talk about how that the trends kind of shift away, you know, during more stable times. I'm wondering, right now in this moment, I'm wondering, what do you think it'll take to create this more consistent culture of gardening?
In one answer, I would say education. I just think that Alice Waters got it so right. If you teach children to garden when they're young, you know, you teach people to play the piano, you teach people to do math, you teach people to drive a car or ride a bicycle or say I'm sorry if they bump into you. It could just be part of anybody's education. And we used to just long ago absorb it by osmosis. It was being done around us. But if that's not happening, I think a school can make a huge difference. And not every school has the space to do it. You know, the ideal city would have a space that any school could use, even if it's just a small plot. You know, I started a garden daycare center when I was a young faculty member at Middlebury College and a mother and busy and all of this. And this was, what, the 70s? I think people were starting to think about what is it's an important thing that government or a municipality could provide for people that would really help women, especially, who work, who have to work, you know. And so we started one, and it was a wonderful project. Loved it. But we had a little garden for the kids. It was very simple. And then the school here in Brooksville, I have a picture of it in the book. It just seemed like a natural thing for them to do. One of the people who works there used to work here. And we urged her to bring kids here, and they loved to come. You know, it was great.
What were some of the things that you think they loved about being here?
We would pull a carrot and wash it off a little bit in the bucket, and they loved it. They called them candy carrots. Because after you've had, and this is during the school year, after you've had some frosts, that's when they're sweet. That's true of kale. It's true of an awful lot of things. They were country kids. It's not like they'd never seen something grow before. I think they liked just the fun of pulling something out of the ground or cutting it.
Well, so your book, I think, does a great job of education. So you're talking about education being a number one barrier for a consistent gardening culture, and specifically at a young age, but you also expand it through your writing for adult learners. Yeah. And I'm wondering about what are some of the misconceptions that people have about getting started gardening? You mentioned people might not think they have enough space or enough time, but you kind of dispel those myths.
I do some suggestions, like the fact that you, even if it's just something the size of this rug in your front yard, it's amazing what you could get out of something the size of this rug.
Yeah.
If you think of it as a garden, you could have, really all you need is one little row of tomatoes, just a few plants. And here's some lettuce, and here's some kale, and here's some beets. Have fresh food year-round. And Elliot has pioneered endlessly about finding ways to take advantage of the seasons where actually plants prefer cool weather as opposed to hot. You know, all of the fruiting ones have to be in summer, really, to get to that fruit and make their seeds and all of that, corn, tomatoes. But all of the greens, you know, don't like it when it's really hot, with few exceptions. And so you take advantage of what's in season. You eat with the seasons. And you can do very, very simple structures. We have had little tiny greenhouses of all kinds, trying out the best way to sell the idea to the average person and what you can make them out of and that kind of thing.
I'm a gardener, and I don't know that I really had read this idea in the way exactly that you put it, but you talk about how managing time based on what you grow, you don't have to have a chaotic gardening season. A lot of people think it's like, it's busy, busy, busy. I need to can all the tomatoes and, you know, freeze all the peaches. And you talk about how you can structure it to, with these season extension modalities, these simple things. You're oh, I don't have to freeze spinach because it's in a cold frame and I can just go and harvest it.
You spread it out over the year, and it doesn't become such a burden. You can still have a job.
Yeah. Yeah, which I think that felt really approachable, that way of doing it. It seems like you really enjoy cooking. It seems like part of your book is sort of an ode to how you celebrate the food when it comes out of the field. Like you talk about you and Elliot sharing the first, like if the, you know, the first peas come in and you pick them.
The first of everything.
Yeah.
It's a little mini celebration. Every day there's something, there's a new one. Yeah, the first pumpkin, the first anything. And there's some days I don't want to cook at all, or I have a deadline, and I might take something, some soup I froze. Sometimes if I have an easy day, I'll make soup and make like six pints of it, put it away, and then some day where I've been in town all day, I just heat it up. You find those little ways of adapting.
Are there other either challenges or blessings to eating with the seasons?
A lot of people have likes and dislikes about food, and you have to grant them that. That's the way they are. And no amount of telling them they can eat their spinach will make them like the spinach if they don't like spinach. You know? But I think I do stick up for the seasonality thing. You know, we miss tomatoes while we don't have them. Those tomatoes will taste all the better when they come around. So, and I still do have a little puree left in the freezer. So
that's one of the tricks is to keep a little to keep you going.
A little bit of that, yeah. And you can can them. I mean, canning takes some energy spent, but you can have it in the pantry. I have stuff in jars like that. But freezing is so much easier if you really have pressed for time. And you'd have to get that crop in and put it up. And you don't have time. Freezing is much faster.
Are there certain foods, obviously tomatoes, that you couldn't live without in the garden? I'm sure there's many, but...
Well, tomato would be one of them, that's for sure. I love squash. We both like all kinds of squash. Winter squash is an underrated entity.
I'm a big fan of winter squash.
Yeah, it makes great soups. It's just, you make little hockey pucks out of it and fry them. Oh, my God, that's delicious.
When you say you make hockey pucks, you cut it?
Let's say it's one of the kinds that have a long handle.
Yes.
And this part of it, you scoop out and put butter in it. And, you know,
yeah.
But this part, you would cut into, as I say, hockey pucks.
Yeah.
And you can do it in the oven, but I like it better in a skillet. I just take some butter or oil. It holds its shape by the skin. You don't necessarily eat the skin. It's so yummy. Just really, really good. And you can deglaze the pan with a little maple syrup if you want.
Yeah.
And I love soups made out of winter squash. Mm-hmm. Really creamy, rich, wholesome, filling soups. Those are good.
We've talked about how you reflect a little bit on, well, a lot on gardening in your life and in society in the book. And there's all this practical wisdom. And I really like this one piece where you write of that gardening is an art of adaptation, contemplation, and expansion of the mind.
Did I say that?
You did. Yeah. And that's some of the humor. You're bringing to life the humor that's on the pages right now, which I appreciate.
The book has way more humor. And I'll tell you how that happened, basically.
Okay.
I mean, I've always been a joker. You know, whenever anybody had to make a funny speech, when I was growing up at school and whatever, they would have me do it. So my writing had been increasingly peppered with that. But when they asked me to start writing a weekly column for the Washington Post, which I did for almost 15 years every week, I had to sit down, and I've always felt this way, even before the Post. How can I make what I'm sitting here all alone writing fun for me? How can I make myself laugh? Because that's really the way it happens. You know, you don't have just have a gift for humor. I think you have a need for humor, you know, and I can't really explain why, but you really just want to see the looniness of life. So having to do this thing every single week, you know, I just tried to make it entertaining for writer and reader. So it was a much more personal way I wrote at that point, you know, because it was how-to stuff, but it was also, you know, how can I get their attention? Because I was trying to seduce them. I was trying to make them at least try gardening. They might be surprised to find out how enjoyable it is. It's not drudgery. It's good exercise and all kinds of good stuff.
You are listening to Common Ground Radio on WERU. I'm Holly Cederholm, and our guest for today is Barbara Damrosch, a lifelong gardener and an acclaimed garden writer. Her latest book is A Life in the Garden, Tales and Tips for Growing Food in Every Season. Common Ground Radio can be heard on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on 89.9 FM and at weru.org. It's brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association.
Well, it works. I mean, it felt like I was conversing with a friend, even though like I wasn't, you know, your voice is shining through the pages. Right. And it was very comforting when I was reading it to just feel the like wittiness and the quips. You're presenting these things that are very serious. You're talking about how gardening has declined and gardening, the root of civilization is at stake. And, you know, they're very serious and philosophical concepts, but then you just imbue it with this lightheartedness.
I think almost anything you should have laughter. I had a grandfather, not the one in Louisiana who grew his own melons and raised his own hogs, but the other one was a Episcopal priest in Pennsylvania. And he had a little bookcase beside his favorite chair, and I would sit in his favorite chair and pull out fun in church, more fun in church, lapses in the apses, smiles in the aisles. They were all humor books about religion, about church. And I just loved that. And that was kind of the way I was raised. That's the way the family was. Everybody in my family, that side of the family, especially my father's side, would compete who was the funniest, you know? And even as a child, I would try to, you know, join in with bad puns and all kinds of things, even as a 12-year-old or something. It just is something that has always helped me through life.
I'm curious about how the relationship between gardening and writing, those have kind of been twin pillars for you in your life. And like, have you learned more about gardening as a writer?
I was living in New York and I went to Columbia. I was working on a PhD in medieval comparative literature. And I taught at three colleges. But I started writing even in grad school just to earn money to survive in New York. And so I would write about mostly political things, mostly feminist. I wrote a lot for the Village Voice and places like that. But I did some funny pieces for Esquire. You know, it just was whoever would pay me money, I would write for. And so when I moved to Connecticut, which had to do with partly reading the Nearings book, and also I think sort of the food movement. It sounds like a silly word, but there was a sort of food movement. It was gaining traction. And I knew that growing food was part of it because from my mother's side of the family, I had that legacy. I wanted to move to Connecticut and raise my son in a nonviolent neighborhood. I couldn't afford to live in any place particularly fancy. I really wanted to grow food. It was something I had a hunger for. So when I got up there to Connecticut, it was a house that my great aunt had lived in and then passed away, and my parents inherited it. So I edited the town paper, but I was also trying to send stuff back to New York. But it was a little hard making what was on my mind interesting and a kind of important for New Yorkers. I just started writing theme gardens, and Regina Ryan, who was the producer that was agenting with me, she had kept a little list over the years. It was really her idea, you know, of a white garden and a children's garden, you name it. And I thought, well, that's really cool. You know, let's play with that. Let's see what we can do with that. So that book was quite successful for what it was. And the first chapter was called A Garden Primer, because I just felt that somebody picked it up. Well, these are lovely ideas, but I don't know how to garden. It needed an introduction that was how to garden, just in one chapter. So we sent things out for serialization, and places like Country Living or something would pick up, you know, one or the other, because it was very easy with a book with themes. You know? Yeah. And Regina said, you know, one person even thought about maybe doing a garden primer as a book. There really isn't a gardening Bible right now. My parents had one that they grew up with and learned from, but there wasn't a big fat book. So I decided to write the big fat book, and it's still around. I think it's actually approached 500,000 copies. Which for a garden book isn't bad.
I'd say so. That's yeah. pretty astonishing. Yeah. Do you feel like in writing that book or your column or this most recent book, do you feel like it, the opportunity to kind of sit with your ideas and explore them on the page? I'm wondering if you felt like you grew as, maybe not grow is the right word as a gardener, but do you feel like trying to explain mm-hmm. it to other people? Like pushed
well,
you
in the beginning, yes, because I was doing a lot of research. I was reading a lot of garden books. And the other thing that happened to me is I married this dude mm-hmm. who knew a lot about gardening.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a mentor for me. Even, I mean, I knew quite a bit, but there was lots of branches, especially with food growing. He didn't know anything about flowers, but I learned a lot from him, and it was wonderful working with him. We've had a great time doing all that together.
So I would like to back up just
yes.
a minute. So
what you, did you ask me?
No. I want to back up to you meeting Elliot because there's an interesting connection that I want
well,
to talk
that's
about.
For sure.
You write about how you were influenced. One of your mentors in the garden was Helen Nearing.
Helen Scott, yeah.
Yeah, and you met Elliot.
I really almost left New York just to be Helen and Scott. I came to this house that my parents owned, but it was so not Helen and Scott. It originally had been maybe built in 1690, but they'd added on all this modern stuff. And there was room for a nice garden. I grew my food all right. I just dug right in. It was really fun. And I was a single mom. But I never did have the pleasure of like going into the woods and chopping down the trees and pulling out the stumps like him. And I was always trying to prove how strong I was. You know, as a little woman in a very mannish field, I may have sort of omitted the whole 10 or 12 years where I did nothing but landscaping and landscape mm-hmm. design. I would take on clients and completely transform their yards, and I was planting trees with a root ball this big and things like that. It's sort of neurotic and dumb thinking about it, but I really was trying to prove that I wasn't this powerless, hopeless little stick of a person. And I really think a lot of people would understand this who have been appraised a certain way. And so that was kind of a high for me. I had been the smallest girl in my class. Even the class below me didn't have a girl as little as me. And so I just did it on my own as a design firm and started writing a lot too.
And you moved to
then I moved to up to Maine, where my parents had re-retired to Blue Hill, and they were gardening, of course. And I really liked it up here. I was protesting the war at the Village Green one day. Every Wednesday, I think it was, we would have a protest, and there'd be this huge banner saying, "We love our troops, bring them home now." And this other little woman and I held different poles. And while we were doing this, she's revealed that they had a house that they rented in Maine, in Brooksville. And not only that, but Helen and Scott Nearing did not live in Vermont the way I thought they did. They live in Brooksville. and Elliot Coleman, whose book was in competition with mine and vice versa, he was yeah. told by his publisher the real threat to his book was not Rodale. It was that little woman. So this woman friend with the pole told me that Elliot lived there too. Or somehow I found it out. Or maybe I even read an article about him. So it all kind of happened. My friend Devine from Connecticut took me over to see Helen. We just walked in. She's used to that. And there was Elliot in the greenhouse with her, tying up her tomatoes. And he showed me around her place, showed me around his place, took me out for pizza, and the rest is history. And that was 34 years ago.
That's sort of a rock star moment. You walk into a greenhouse and it has both Elliot Coleman and Helen Nearing.
It was kind of a rock star moment. That's true.
So speaking of some of these mentors, Helen and Elliot, I want to talk about a different kind of mentor. So you talk about gardening in nature's image and looking to nature as sort of a guide for your gardening. And that seems to be like a big part of your life, is to not only participate in gardening and cultivating food, but to do it in a way that is in alignment with the world. Right. I'm curious.
Well, see.
Yeah.
Go with them. Well,
I'm curious, what lessons have you learned by embodying that, or what led you in that direction?
Well, I think of it not as an opinion, but as a fact. Mm-hmm. I'm that pig-headed about it. We're all completely subject to nature's laws. And you come up against them more intimately in the garden than you would, say, brokering stocks and bonds or anything that isn't physical. It's not physical versus non-physical. It's much more just the holistic view of our place on this planet, what we're doing to it, what we should be doing. And it was part of my whole sort of rebellious 60s, 70s way of thinking. I wasn't the only person thinking that way then, and I still am thinking that way. It was indelible to me. I was more into that than my sort of lefty counterparts in Manhattan who didn't get it at all. I mean, to them it had more to do with labor unions and pacifism, which of course is very nearing Sarah, yeah, too, but they didn't get this thing about how I wanted to grow my own food and just didn't understand why I would want to come up here and, as partly political act, grow my own food. They found that completely frivolous and unimportant.
Do you think people who are, you know, returning to caring about the food system, but do you think that...
Oh yeah, we're doing our bit. We're not solving every problem. I think it's definitely a healthy trend. Absolutely. No question about it. Learning how to grow things. But doing it in a way that doesn't disrupt. You don't go around spraying poisons all over your garden. It might get rid of this bug, but maybe that bug was eating that bug. There's a whole thing out there that we barely comprehend. And we're looking for one single answer in a can, a spray can. You know, it's insane. So you need to open your eyes, and sometimes you need to read stuff. The things out there that are happening are very, very tiny. A lot of them you can't see at all. Or you may see a bird doing something, but you don't know why it's doing that. It's a combination of being out there in it, observing it, but also reading what people have studied and found out.
And it almost sounds like there's an element of trust or faith. Like you've read the things, but you also trust that there's a possibility that that bug is doing more
There's too much fear of nature. Just, it seems so overwhelming, so out of our control. And that's okay. No one organism rules the planet. We may think we do, or we need to, or we'd like to, or we're trying to, but we're not gonna do it. By trying too hard, we're doing it with too much ignorance and overlooking what is going along just fine. I often just say gardening is standing back and taking a look and seeing what nature's already doing and not stand in its way. Mm-hmm. That's really it in a nutshell. If I had to put it all into one sentence, it would be that one.
This has been Common Ground Radio, which airs on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on WERU Community Radio. Archives of previous episodes can be found on WERU.org, as well as the WERU app. I'd like to thank Barbara for joining me in conversation. I'd also like to thank the show's editor, Claire Boland. Stay tuned for more great programming.